For argument is Lopez versus Gonzalez, Mr. Belgrau.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Scott Belgrau and I represent the appellants in this matter. The issue before the Court today, I believe, is a very simple one. In our brief, we framed it in three different ways. First was the judge's denial of our motion to reopen an abuse of discretion. Secondly was the judge's decision based on substantial evidence. And third, did the denial violate my client's right to due process? All of these issues turn on whether or not the judge properly considered the evidence that we presented before him and whether he issued a rational and a reasoned decision. Now, in analyzing the judge's decision, I'd ask the Court to keep in mind three different sets of dates. The first sets of dates would be when the NTA was issued, the notice to appear, and when the hearing notice was issued. Those documents were issued in June and then September of 2000. The second set of dates I'd ask the Court to consider are the dates for the evidence that we submitted in support of our motion, namely a letter from the Department of State or the National Visa Center to our client at her new address, and bank statements addressed to our client at her new address. The third date would be the date that my client's husband received the certified mail for the bag and baggage letter, and that was in 2001. That is the last in time of all the evidence in the case. Now, in reaching his decision, the judge based his decision entirely on the fact that my client's husband signed for the bag and baggage letter. Essentially, what the judge held was that since that letter was received, my client must never have moved. And that was the first half of his decision. The second half of the decision, and I quote here, thus, if the respondent did move, it appears that it was after she failed to appear for your hearing. Moreover, the fact that the National Visa Center may have received a new address does not relieve the respondent of her notification requirements to the immigration court. The second half of the decision implies that the judge is acknowledging that there was a move, but that move happened after she received the notice to appear, after the in absentia order was entered. That contradicts with the first half of the statement, first half of the decision, which states that she must have never moved because she received the bag and baggage letter, the last in time piece of evidence in the record. I would also point out, as was stated in our brief, that the judge's reliance on the bag and baggage letter should not be absolute. First, the issue here is whether my client received the notice to appear and whether she received the notice of the hearing. Although the bag and baggage letter does relate to that, it's not an absolute determination. Secondly, the bag and baggage letter was sent by certified mail. The notice to appear and the notice of hearing were both sent by regular mail. It's conceivable that the postman, having seen that going to the door of apartment number 10, realizing my client did not live there but was down the hallway in a different building in the same complex, would have taken the certified letter to the new address.
Is it conceded that your client never gave notice of the move?
To whom?
To the immigration authorities. Isn't she obligated regulation to give notice of
correct.
Any change
she did not notify them pursuant to the regulations. She did notify the Department of State. The letter that we submitted shows that they were sending her correspondence at her new address. She did not notify the immigration court, but that was because she never received the notice to appear, and pursuant to GYR, she's under no requirement to notify the immigration court until she receives notice to appear, which states in it that she has a duty to notify the court of any moves.
So what happened when her husband signed for the bag and baggage letter?
Correct.
Yeah. So what did he do with it? Did he tell her about it?
I don't know. He does not recall receiving it. We were not aware of it when we filed our original motion. We first learned about it in the reply to our original motion to reopen. I would point out that was received about a year and a half after the...
Well, isn't it a reasonable inference that he showed it to her and that she decided, well, the less she has to do with these people, the better?
Your Honor, my client at the time had already filed one adjustment of status application.
Yeah, but it had been denied, right?
It was improperly filed. She had
been
swindled.
Whatever it was, she was denied, so maybe she felt, you know, better not to deal with these people.
That may have been what happened. That does not would not change the fact that she did not receive the notice to appear on the notice of hearing.
Anything further? Or is that your argument?
I would just reiterate the points.
Well, don't reiterate. Do you have something new to say, or are you just going to repeat yourself?
The judge did not, in his opinion, mention any of the evidence that we presented to him. And judging from the inconsistencies in his opinion, I would question whether or not he even considered our evidence, whether he saw the receipt for the baggage letter and simply based his decision entirely on the receipt of the certified letter rather than considering our evidence and giving our client a fair shot.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Belgrad. Mr. Palau?
Good morning, Your Honor. Manuel Palau for the Attorney General. A motion to reopen, such as we have here, presents a fact question to the IJ. And the fact question is, did the petitioner actually receive the notice to appear and the hearing notices? Here, the facts and the record demonstrate that there were three mailings made to her. All were to apartment number 10, an address she gave the INS when she filed her adjustment application. In addition, we have a certified mailing that was made to her, actually signed for by her husband. So we have three of which were not returned as undeliverable, and a fourth which was actually received. And the IJ reasonably concluded that in light of this evidence, the fact that he found was that she remained at apartment 10 the entire time, her former address. The opposing evidence is much less informative as to where she lived. Her evidence about her moving was an unsigned promissory note signed by her in-laws who formerly occupied her new residence. That proves nothing relevant. She also has two pieces of mail addressed to her husband at a point in time. One is after the NTA was mailed to her.
Well, but isn't it possible that she didn't submit more compelling evidence of her move, like a new lease or an electric bill, because the Lopez's simply took over the existing lease and utility accounts from the in-laws when they moved? I mean, you know, I would think that that immigrants who are unfamiliar with language and the red tape of utility account changes, you know, they just might find it simply easier to unofficially take over an existing lease and accounts of the in-laws who had moved. We're not dealing here, I take it, with sophisticated, university-educated people. I mean, the average person has enough trouble with the gas company and the electric company and all the rest of them.
Well, Your Honor, that's certainly possible. The IJ cannot afford to speculate or conjecture. The fact of the matter is that based on the evidence in the record before him, that there were two ways this could have come out. He could have concluded, okay, she moved when she says she did, or he could have concluded, as he did, that the stronger evidence is that she received the three notices and the certified mailing at apartment 10 because she didn't move. And it's not a de novo situation. I believe that the better evidence in the record before the IJ supports his finding, and it's a fact, administrative finding of fact. I don't dispute that. I believe what we have here, I'm not going to call it a failure of proof, but certainly more compelling evidence could have been produced. You know, I would note that there's not one piece of paper in the record that has the petitioner's name and her new address on it together at the same time.
Now, what about a hearing? She didn't get a hearing. Is she entitled to a hearing?
No. She had her hearing at the which she didn't appear for. In a situation where you have an in absentia removal order, the remedy, as Mr. Belgrad pursued, is a motion to reopen before the IJ who entered the in absentia order. And as the rules provide that, in that motion you provide all of your proof as to why you did not receive the notice to appear. And that was done here. Affidavits were provided, documents were provided, but the IJ did not, he ruled the other way as a matter of fact.
When does the duty to notify of an address change kick in?
Well, first, it's a general duty. Every person who's here present in the country does have a statutory duty to notify the INS of their address. There's also, also she'd filed previously an adjustment application that was denied. At that time, she gave the INS the apartment 10 address to which all the notices were mailed to. That's the second point. The third time is the NTA itself, the notice to appear, the initial document in the removal proceeding, that sets forth an obligation to notify the court of any address changes after you receive the NTA. And I believe what the IJ did here was, since the NTA was mailed to her at apartment 10, it was not returned to INS undeliverable, he found that she received the NTA and charged her with the obligation in the NTA to report any address changes to the INS from that point forward. So he found as a fact that she received the NTA, that triggered the address change obligation.
Well, the failure to notify of the address change was an alternate grounds for the IJ's decision declining to reopen?
The sole basis was his fact finding that she in fact received all the notices pertaining to this removal proceeding. And that was the sole issue before him on a motion to reopen. It's a fact question. Did she actually receive the notices or not? And I would submit that on the record, before the IJ, there's no way that he could have known for sure. There's nothing conclusive for him to know what really happened. But there certainly is enough evidence, the better evidence, the third-party evidence, the non-return of the mailings, and the actual receipt of the certified mailing all support his finding that she remained at Apartment 10, and since all the mailings went there, she got the notices she was entitled to. I would point out, apropos of Judge Posner's question, her husband got this certified mailing in November of 2001, so we have pretty conclusive proof of actual receipt. It wasn't until January of 2005 that she filed a motion to reopen over 3 years later. So that would kind of support, to me, the conclusion that when she receives the notices, she doesn't promptly act on them. That's just another indication supported by the facts in this case. So I think what we have here is a very simple fact question. The judge made a finding that could have come out either way, but I believe the better evidence under the deferential review standard here is that his finding of fact is supported by the evidence in the record.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Collins.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Belgrau, how much time does he have? 4 minutes?
I'd first like to address the issue of the amount of evidence submitted on my client's behalf with the initial motion to reopen. As with most cases like this, my client came in and contacted me prior to a second bag and baggage letter that was had been sent to her. Our original motion was filed about a week before she was set to appear at immigration to be removed from the United States. It was filed under a very strict time frame. We didn't have time to obtain more evidence. We certainly would have liked to have tried to. I want to also point out the evidence we did submit wasn't addressed by the judge. He doesn't mention it in his decision at all. In fact, his decision is a mere 7 sentences long, and I think the discussion we're having shows that there are more issues that need to be addressed and that needs to be addressed in a decision that takes more than one paragraph. I'd also like to point out that our motion to reopen, we did not receive a hearing before the immigration judge on it. The motion to reopen was filed. We received a response from the government, and the case was denied, and that was it. We did not have an opportunity to file a response brief, and we did not have an opportunity to have an oral argument in front of the immigration judge.
Did you ask for an oral argument or for leave to file a response?
No, I did not, Your Honor. Common practice is that, though there are not oral arguments for these kinds of cases before the immigration judge.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Belgrau.
Thank you.
Next case for argument is Sevilla versus